I thank you for this opportunity to share some thoughts with you and to call us to something that I think is very urgent. Today in the churches of Christ, we're facing an identity crisis. We don't quite know who we are. We don't quite know what we're supposed to be saying, and we're not quite sure where we should be going. Now, this is not true in every congregational setting, obviously, but it's widely enough spread, and it is common enough among us that I think we'll all understand what I say when I say we're facing an identity crisis. If this congregation here is not as a congregation, there are hundreds of congregations represented by this assembly tonight who are facing that identity crisis, and those of you who are here who make up this congregation from other congregations know what I refer to when I make that statement. The zero growth among us has forced us to re-examine our roots, to re-examine our message, to re-examine our methods. There are alternatives that are beckoning us, and if we fail to recognize that Jesus Christ is the only life giver, we're going to fall prey to two or three alternatives that bring nothing but death. I think you're aware that Jesus of Nazareth is the only life giver. And any other thing or any other approach viewed as an alternative to him is merely a treadmill leading to a death trap, and we must avoid it. There is among us, and I just this month was in a congregation that had already accepted and had verbalized the circling of the wagon mentality. They were living or they existed in a downtown setting. The many congregations had been formed from that congregation. Others had just left out of desperation. And the ones that were there as leaders had expressed that they were just trying to maybe maintain their existence, to keep house until finally the congregation would just somehow or other cease to exist. And many members stated that they are hoping that the congregation just lasts as long as they're alive. And it was very foreboding, a depressed mentality there, the circling of the wagons. But for those who have decided to do something to address the zero growth that is affecting us today, there are those of us who have turned to emotionalism and the stirring up of a lot of emotional dust. But emotionalism only brings, it brings also death eventually. Then there are those among us who have approached the problem with promotionalism by the hiring of some Fifth Avenue preacher who is more gifted at gimmicks than he is at gospel and does more promoting than he does proclaiming. That is probably one of the larger dangers that's facing us today. But then the one that's stirring up the most dust and the most disturbance is that of a renewed legalism, a legalism that has teeth in it, and I mean big teeth, a legalism that has some grip to it, and it is this one that is becoming very prevalent among the churches of Christ. It is affecting us almost at every level and almost in every location, and the whole world has been targeted by these people known as the discipling ministries or the discipling churches. It is this group that has become very psychologically damaging. It is this area that we're addressing in our work in Boston. We have been with the Burlington Church for about 4 years. As of March the 31st, Louine and I resigned from that work and have made it our full-time work to pick up on those who are walking away from the discipling ministry of the Boston Church. We have calculated that in the last five to six years, according to their own figures, we have calculated that they have had about 1,500 people walk away from the Boston Church, that there are 1,500 people walking around in the Boston area. Many of them, majority of them, have not surfaced yet. About 10% have surfaced and have come to us and have placed membership in some existing church or churches around that area. But about 90% have not yet surfaced, and we are now addressing those people and taking the initiative to try to bring them to see that there is a viable alternative. But the question that I want us to ask is, if we're not going to go with the discipling ministers or the discipling ministries approach, if we're not going to approach Christianity and we're not going to preach the message and implement the methods of the discipling ministries, what are we going to do? What are we calling people to? if we're not going to go with the Boston mentality and the Boston methodology, what are we offering people? Do you know? Have you thought it through? And it probably is true that this town will never be targeted with a discipling ministry's alternative. But you're going to be going out of this congregation to other places that will very definitely be targeted for a discipling ministry. What do you plan to offer them? What do you plan to recommend? Let me tell you a brief story. A man and his wife and two children came from the Boston church to the Burlington church. They began to visit and began to kind of flirt with the idea. They finally made their decision that they could no longer maintain the pace. They could no longer stand the tension, the stress of the Boston, the discipling ministries. And so they came to the Burlington church and eventually placed membership with us. But I began to notice almost immediately the nose of this man began to raise a bit as he began to look down his nose at all the people at Burlington and to discredit their, discredit their Christianity in a sense. And he began to kind of look down his nose at all of us, and he was becoming very disturbed and very ill at ease. We went to his house one night to eat supper. They're very hospitable people and fine people. And this brother began to verbalize what was troubling him. And he began to say in such so many terms, or so many words, he said, when is Burlington going to get on the stick? Now that's paraphrasing. He didn't use the word stick. But he didn't have to, because that's what he was saying plainly. He was saying, when are you going to see to it that the people in the Burlington church get on with the program and get on down the road and get these things implemented and start? Well, I listened to him for a good long while and let him get it off his chest. But then I said, Jay, hold on just a minute. I said, let me get this straight now. I said, you left the Boston church because you were not able to keep up with the pace and you were not able to tolerate the stress level that they were binding upon you from other people binding it from the outside upon you. You left there because you couldn't tolerate that. Now, I said, are you meaning to tell me that you're going to then come here from there, having left that level of stress, and you're going to come here to Burlington, and now you're going to set the level of stress that you can cope with, and you're going to place it upon all the rest of us and make the rest of us uncomfortable? Is that what you're saying? Well, he kind of smiled in surprise. But I said, that's precisely what you're saying. I said, you're saying that you couldn't stand that, but you're going to come here now, and you're going to lower the level of stress to where you can cope with it, and you're going to put it upon the rest of us and make us uncomfortable. I said, brother, we're trying to do something entirely different. I said, what we're trying to do is to discover the alternative to the external motivation that has been the driving force of the Boston church. What we're trying to do is to discover an internal motivation that allows each individual person, because of his loving response to Jesus Christ, we're trying to allow the freedom that is accompanied that, we're trying to allow that freedom to be exercised by members of the body, and that will be our motivation, not some external motivation. But I want to ask us the question tonight. As we look for an alternative to the discipling ministers among us, are we going to be content to simply reduce the level of legalism, to reduce the stress level to where we can cope with it, and yet maintain the same external motivation that is characteristic of the discipling ministers? There may be many of you here that don't really know what the discipling ministries are, and I apologize for that. I won't be able to go into it in detail enough, but I'll just say a few things along the way. But the main concern that I have tonight is, if not that, what? If not that, what? You see, there's been among us in the churches of Christ for the last, and I'll just pull a number out of the air, for the last 75 years, there has been in existence among us a benevolent legalism for the last 75 years. Depending on the location where you are, depending on the time in which you live, depending on the leaders under which you serve, there has been a type of legalism that has held in and is being held in place and that has held sway in the churches of Christ for the last some 75 or so years in the mainstream church. Now, theologically, this has not been so true. And I don't mean that legalism has not characterized our theology. I mean that benevolent legalism has not characterized our theology. We have not been very benevolent in our legalism theologically. In fact, we've been very vicious. And people have been ridden out of the church over simple things like the difference in translations. They've been ridden out of the church for various things that, in your mind's eye, probably would not amount to a hill of beans. But there have been some people so rigid in their legalism and so rigid in their convictions that they would not allow the freedom of people to be exercised and the diversity to be allowed in the body of Christ that would guarantee the freedom that we have in Christ. But in terms of social conduct, we have had in place a benevolent legalism. Everyone hasn't had to be just alike. Everyone hasn't had to do just exactly alike. There's been a diversity allowed. There's been a freedom allowed. And I think for several reasons. One reason being that the churches of Christ have had their greatest strength in those parts of the United States that we know of as the Bible Belt. And because of that fact, we have found ourselves growing most prolifically in those areas of the country whose social conduct and social consciousness has been so similar to our own that there hasn't been the distance between us and the culture in which we live. Plus the fact that our approach has been to people, when we project the good news to them, when we preach a message to the people, and when we target those to whom we're going to target project our message, it has been to religious people that we've made our approach. We have not been known as people who've been down in the gutter talking to people whose lifestyle is so drastically different from our own. We have approached people in the Bible Belt, in the cultural setting that has been enough like us, and then in that setting, we have zeroed in on people who are religious people. People who already believe the Bible, they already believe in Christ, they already believe in the church, they already believe in the many things, the moral standards and all, that we ourselves believe in. So what has happened is that the people that we have been approaching have had just a very short distance to come to be just about like us anyway. So whatever pressure there was that was needed, it wasn't very much to make them just like what we ourselves are. And so for that reason, it has been it's been a type of benevolent legalism. But in the legalism of the discipling ministries, we're witnessing there not a benevolent legalism. We're witnessing a malevolent legalism. Now, I know, and I've said this to them over and over and over, and I'm not saying anything to you that I haven't said to them. I've told the elders this. I've told Kip this. But in particular, I've told the elders over and over and over again all of this that I'm telling you. There is a malevolent legalism holding forth in the discipling ministries. And I think for several reasons. Number one, the people that they're addressing are not anything like what they are. The people to whom they present their message, the people are about as different from the Boston church as night is from day. And they're approaching anybody on any street corner from any country, any color of skin, any language, any nationality. It doesn't matter. Any religion, they don't care. They are so bold in their doctrine and so bold in their approach, and I commend them for that. I'm not criticizing them for that. I'm trying to explain why it is that the legalism that is held true there is such a malevolent legalism. And that is the distance that they have to cover, the people. The distance that they have to cover in order to become like the discipling ministries, like the Boston Church, the distance is so vast. Plus, compounding that, the amount of time that is allowed for that transition to take place is so small. When you compound the two and factor those two in, the distance to cover is so vast and the time limit is so small, when you factor those together, you come out with a legalism that is very psychologically damaging. And as a result, you have people living their lives by somebody else's faith rather than their own. And diversity is not allowed in the discipling ministries. You come out like a cookie out of a cookie cutter. You come out, as Landon Saunders said, it's a franchise. Every burger is to be cooked exactly the same length at the same temperature. And everyone comes out looking just alike. And that's very true. They themselves who have left have admitted that that's certainly one of the things that happened to them. But I'm just making this observation for this reason, that the methodology of the discipling churches and the mainstream church, the methodology is essentially the same. It differs mainly in degree only. Someone has wisely said, they are where we would be had we had gotten where we were going. That's right, and that's disturbing. That's disturbing. Because when I see in them the elitism, the exclusivism, the hard-nosed legalism that I see in them that crushes and crunches and bears heavily upon people, I detest it. But I lower my finger when I realize that they're our children. They're our children. Without any question, they are our children. And you know, the very thing that we can't stand in our children, you know what it is? It's what we ourselves have always done in front of them, but we excuse it in us and we can't stand it in them. That's a great deal of the discomfort that they cause when they're around us and when we're in their midst. It's that they are just about what we are, and they are what we would have been had we got where we were going. But the one common denominator that I want to urge us to consider tonight as we prepare for a conclusion that I want to suggest to you, and that is that there has been among us a benevolent legalism. Now, if that's not true of the college church, and I'm sure it isn't really true here, I know you well enough to know that, but I'm convinced of the fact that there are enough of you from congregations all over this country. I know you've come out of congregations that are little groups of people who have either a very dictatorial leadership, or you have a very rigid methodology, or you have a very unbendable morality in the sense that you do not even tolerate any variation. You've come out of congregations like that. You've come out of cultural settings like that. And I know that you'll understand what I mean by that first common denominator between the discipling ministers and us. They have a legalism that's in force or in place, but we also have had one. But ours, for these other reasons, have been benevolent. Theirs, for the reasons stated, has become malevolent. But there's another common denominator between the mainstream churches and the discipling churches, and that is that both of us have assumed the presence of faith rather than allowing for the process to be worked through. Let me say it again. We have both assumed the presence of faith rather than allowing for the process. Now, I made this accusation publicly to the elders of the Boston Church in a preacher's meeting on November the 11th, 1987, at which meeting, the next meeting, James Walters from here spoke on the question, in the process of bringing people from the realm of the flesh to the realm of the Spirit, is it necessary or biblical to bring them through the realm of law? Of course, Al Baird, one of the elders at the Boston Church, took the position, the affirmative position, and says, yes, it is necessary. And he took the defensive and said, yes, and we defend the right to do that. We defend that process. James Walters came and, in a very beautiful stroke of Christian genius, just backed away and let us see a whole new vision of a morality that is dependent not upon someone else's enforcing his faith upon you, but allowing you to walk under the freedom of Jesus Christ by His Spirit according to the level of faith that God has given you. But we have both assumed the presence of faith, both in the people that we're addressing with the gospel and in among our own members as well. In the mainstream church and in the discipling church, here's the evidence that is astonishing to me. We have been for years an Acts-oriented church. Our doctrine has been Acts-oriented. It has centered in the book of Acts. We've done that. I've told you this, and we've discussed this for years. They have come along thinking that they have created something new, and it's not anything new at all. It's just a re-resurrecting of the same mentality that would make the book of Acts the center of the teaching process rather than going back to the Gospels. Implying that we have assumed that the presence of faith is in place in both the people that we're teaching to become Christians and in those people who are already members of the church. We're still Acts-oriented and letters-oriented rather than Gospels-oriented. That's some of the evidence that I see of it. In the mainstream church, our being guilty, if you please, of assuming the presence of faith, our assuming the presence of faith, I think, stems from two or three factors that are related to what we've already said. One, we have gradually lapsed into it over the passing of years. You see, we are a generation, we are a movement that is about five or six generations old. There are some people here who are fourth and fifth generation Christians, and they're still alive. But we have lapsed into it. And plus the fact that the people that, of course, that were our grandfathers, some of them were elders, some of them were preachers, some of them were deacons, some of them were fine Christian, upstanding men and women. And in a sense, we have unconsciously said to these people that are in our generation, I know that you must believe. Your grandfather was an elder at Waco, or he was an elder at Little Rock, or your father was an elder, or he was a deacon here, or your mother's a great Christian woman, I know that you must believe. And so we have assumed, because of the fact that we are in this movement, we've been in it, and maybe for the fourth or fifth generation we're in it, and we've assumed that because of that, we have a church that is a living church, and that their faith is a living faith. I do not believe that that's true. We cannot assume that. It was when we came here nearly 16 years ago. It was at this location that I made the decision that I would no longer address any assembly as though it were a believing assembly. Now, that wasn't because so many of you were just plain downright atheists. It wasn't that. But I became aware of the fact that we had some 2,000 or 3,000 students coming in here every year, and that they were coming from backgrounds where faith had been assumed and the process had not been allowed. We had not allowed ourselves. We weren't equipped to do it. We didn't really know how to deal with people who were not believers. We didn't know how to deal with the atheist. We didn't know how to deal with the infidel. And we just about took the route that would lead us to, so we would not come into contact with those people, and we would go rather to the religious people, and we would assume the presence of faith in those religious people. In the mainstream church, our assuming the presence of faith has come about by our gradually lapsing into it over many years. That's not true in the discipling movement. They are in such a position not because they've gradually lapsed into it over the years, but because of the simple fact they are in such a rush. They are in such a rush to meet the projection of their own growth to the point that they don't have time to allow a person to work through his faith and to come to a personal loving faith in Jesus Christ. They don't have time. And consequently, without time, and faith takes time, it takes a varying amount of time depending on the person's heart. But because of the fact that they have this overbearing, overwhelming sense of urgency that must get the movement on its way and must maintain a geometrical progression of growth, because of that, they have assumed the presence of faith in the people that they approach also. And as a result, in both their case and in the mainstream church, we have people living off of someone's faith other than their own. And in the discipling ministry's approach, in their methodology, it is so damaging because of the speed, the urgency, the intensity, and all of that, that requires people to almost in frantic response to someone's pressure from without. You have them living a life according to someone else's faith and not their own. And you know, whenever you make your appeal to people and the response that they give to your message, whenever you make it depend not so much on their own faith, but on pressure, upon intimidation, upon the leverage of guilt and the fear tactics when you tell them, or when they're told, you know, you could die on the airplane going home, you better be baptized, you better do it now, don't wait. And I know that maybe we're not totally free of that kind of urgency, but I'm saying that in the discipling ministries, it is compounded because they have such an urgency about them. They're in such a rush. And instead of the internal motivation by the Spirit, which is produced by the loving, faithful response of a person to the evidence about Jesus Christ, instead of that internal motivation, there is an external motivation that is moving them. And as a result, a legalism has been in place. A legalism that is, as I've said, damaging and destructive. And as a result of the of faith not being the motivator, as a result then of the Spirit of Christ not being the indweller, as a result then of all of these things, and the legalism being the only alternative to what they're our activity, then we've been robbed of freedom. In the reading tonight, the reading just simply says we've been called to freedom. Don't let anybody bring you again under another yoke of bondage. For freedom, Christ has set us free. And wherever the Spirit of the Lord is, there's freedom. And I've kept mentioning this to the Boston people, and they say, but we're getting more and more into the Gospels. And I said, well, the time that you can test it, and the way you can test it is this. When you restore to your people the freedom that the Spirit of Jesus Christ guarantees everyone who follows Him, I said, then you'll know you're getting into the life of Jesus and that He is the one that's motivating you to do what you're doing. But we mustn't settle now, as we then began to react to this movement. We cannot afford to just settle for a legalism that is toothless. And I mean by that, it doesn't have any grip on people. We can't afford to do that. If the mainstream church doesn't have some viable alternative to their legalism other than just a toothless legalism, then I don't think we have the right to call them to anything. In fact, they're not going to listen to anything. They're smart enough to know that what they've been in, at least in one perspective or from one perspective, has been very productive. It's crushing a lot of people. A lot of people are being mashed through the cracks. But there is a type of growth and a type of activity that resembles what happens when you give a body a shot of steroids. It is an artificially imposed, externally imposed type of motivation that causes an enormous growth, but the side effects are not all that inviting. If the mainstream church accepts faith as our only motivator, and we're going to have to face the fact that we've been a group of people who, instead of preaching and proclaiming that faith is that which saves us, we've been a people who have said, well, faith, yes, but faith, but. And we've spent much of our history talking about things and talking about things that would indicate that, yes, it is faith, but. And so we've come down to be known by the people around us as people who really don't believe in faith. And we don't believe that faith is the motivator. And so as a result, we're going to have to bite the bullet, accept the fact that we have been viewed as that, and get down to maintaining that faith is our only motivator. This is going to require a personal and intimate consideration of the evidence of Jesus Christ that we find in the Gospels. That's the only alternative we've got if we're going to go with faith in Jesus as the motivator. We're going to have to take the time. We're going to have people. We're going to have parents. We're going to have teachers and preachers in the pulpit and elders who are our shepherds, who know the Lord in a personal and an intimate way, and who keep holding Him up for people to see Him and thus be transformed into the likeness of Jesus through viewing Him with loving adoration. It's going to require a personal and intimate consideration of the evidence about Jesus found in the Gospels. Secondly, it's going to involve the risk that goes along with allowing faith to be that which develops in our hearts as the motivator. It's going to allow for questions. It's going to allow for doubts. It's going to allow people to stand up and say, I don't know whether I believe this or not. It's going to allow our children to say, but Daddy, I don't believe that yet. And it's going to allow them, it's going to require the parents, it's going to require our teachers, it's going to require our elders to simply sit down and say, well, come on, let's talk about it. But thank you for bringing it out in the open. And it's going to free us from the burden of having to stuff it every time there's a question of our own faith. It's going to allow us the freedom to say, but wait a minute, I don't yet believe that. I may come to it, I don't necessarily disbelieve it, but it's going to require us to allow for the risk that goes with allowing faith to develop. And I'm convinced that we're going to have to grant that freedom if we ever get down to the root canal and allow something other than cosmetic theology to be done among us. In 1970, when Louise and I came back through Europe, we stopped in Vienna, Austria, because she had a filling that fell out of her tooth. Well, that wasn't any problem. The dentist just simply took her in, put her in the seat, and drilled that filling out. It was already out. He just cleaned it up, put another filling back in, and sent her home. When the Novocaine wore off, Louine realized that the man had just plugged an abscessed tooth. And the pressure began to build. And as the pressure began to build, her face just about came off because of the pain. I'm afraid what he should have done was to go on and bite the bullet. It would have taken a little bit more time. Whether he was on his vacation and didn't want to bother with it, I don't know. But he should have gone on and done a root canal. That's where the problem was. It wasn't in the filling. I'm convinced that if we're going to produce anything other than a prolonged season of pain in those who are the adherents of this movement, we're going to have to take the time, bite the bullet, and allow for a root canal to be done on our own faith, and it's going to allow each person that freedom to examine Jesus Christ on his own. And it's going to require also a third thing. That is the uneasiness that comes from walking by faith. Nobody likes to walk by faith. We would all rather walk by sight. Every last one of us in this room would rather walk by sight. There's an uneasiness that accompanies a walking by faith to where you don't quite know exactly how everything ought to be done. There's a humility that goes with walking by faith because you recognize that you don't have all the answers. They were not settled 50 or 75 years ago and handed down to us on a silver platter. That simply was not the way that walking by faith is to be accomplished. We are uneasy in walking by faith, but it's not only going to cause uneasiness. When you start letting your brother walk by faith, that just causes downright nervousness. We can stand the uneasiness that comes with our being thrown upon our faith. But when it comes to granting Him the freedom of walking by His level of faith, and that you're not going to impose your faith upon Him, that causes downright nervousness. But that's a part of what we're going to have to do. I'm convinced that if we return to faith as our motivator, it's going to require this freedom for diversity in the church today. Let me just conclude with an observation. There are two major fields that I'm convinced have to be addressed if we're going to have any viable alternative to approach these people with and to approach the world with. In place of the authoritarian and pyramidic form of rulership, there is an authoritarian form of leadership in the Boston and discipling ministries. There is a pyramid type of leadership that places one man at the top and then various roles of leadership and various roles of authority after that. It is elitist, it is exclusivistic, and it is psychologically damaging. If we're going to have anything as an alternative to present as an option to those particular characteristics, it will be in these two areas. We're going to have to be willing to go back and explore the basis of faith. Each individual person must be allowed to process his faith rather than just our assuming the presence of faith. And then the second thing, and I alluded to that this morning, we're going to have to revive hospitality. And I know that many of you are doing it constantly, and that's wonderful. But brethren, one of the things that is a gap and a void in the mainstream churches today is the good, solid, sound practice of hospitality. In the Boston ministries and in the discipling ministries, it's not so much hospitality there as it is a constant being one-on-one with someone that resembles more what you would call, monitoring. It's a monitoring, but it's almost a 24-hour monitoring. There, you're liable to be called any time of the day or night to ask how you're doing and what are you doing about this particular sin in your life and are you addressing this lack and are you doing something about this. And there's this constant one-over-one instead of one-on-one. It's a one-over-one, but it has provided not only the motivation, but it has provided the responsibility and what they call not responsibility, but they call it accountability. Accountability. And you are accountable to someone. And you don't spend a day. You don't go through a day of your life. You hardly go through any hours of your life without someone to whom you are accountable asking you what you're doing about your life. When the people come out of those discipling movements, they come out of there precisely for that reason. They cannot stand somebody walking through their life with hobnail boots. But you know what it leaves? Whenever they walk away, it leaves such a huge void. It leaves a huge void. And if they come in then into congregations of the mainstream church, where in many places arm-length religion is already being practiced, where there's no real fellowship in the homes, where the only time the members see themselves are in an assembly like this, where there is no calling up just simply out of genuine love and concern, there's very little approaching, there's very little monitoring at all. When they come into mainstream churches that have no genuine basis of fellowship like hospitality in our homes, the void is too much. They can't handle it. And as a result, they conclude that we're not really the kind of people that we ought to be. These people, when they're coming out of the discipling movements, they look for activity that is genuine. They would settle for a toothless legalism. They would settle for reducing the level of stress. But when they finally see that that's not even going to be provided, that they're going to have to work through their faith, but in the meantime, while they're working through it, they're going to be accepted by a loving group of people who want them in their home, who want to sit down and talk with them, who want to be with them. If we can address these two issues, I think we will be on target in providing an alternative that will bring life to these people. As it is, they're dying by the hundreds. As it is, they're being crushed with an intolerable burden. Those people who are doing the crushing justify what they're doing on the basis that this is what's required to bring people to maturity. I do not believe that's true. But if we don't produce faith in ourselves and lead them to process their faith, and then in the meantime allow them the gentle, warm fellowship that comes from hospitality and care, if we'll do those two things, then we'll have an alternative to present to them. is it for me, dear Savior? Let's stand and encourage one another. Whoever may need to respond for whatever reason, come while we sing and let's encourage one another.